Austin Wardell, who was the physician with the Young Husband Expedition, wrote a very interesting and remarkable book on Tibet. But he also wrote not as a scholar in esoteric matters, but as an excellent recorder of such facts as he could put together from native records and accounts. Most were also limited by the inability to speak the language. Very few Tibetans have ever taught outside of their country. Those who have, apparently, have never really taught their religious philosophy, whether they have discussed the literature, arts, general culture of the country. Therefore, from the time of Abhayavak, whom Madame Blavatsky calls the Lama of Jehovah, down to the present time, we have very little authentic information relating to the more profound religious beliefs of these people. There are only two writers who have brought out somewhat flawed accounts have to be taken with certain reservation simply because they cannot be checked. And where it is obvious that they have romanticized their subject material, it is not certain to what degree their exaggerations have gone. Madame Blavatsky was in Tibet, and according to the letter of endorsement that was written by the Panchen Lama, she was at the monastery palace at Tashi Lampu, where she had access to the Tibetan libraries and other religious material. Yet in going through her writings, we find also very few actual facts that can be traced directly to Tibetan sources. Most of her philosophy arose either in India or in one of the Buddhist areas, such as Ceylon. So we only have an occasional evidence of actual Tibetanism. Some, perhaps, in other books beside the Sutra Doctrine. Some fragments in what is now called the third volume of this work, and in the modern Pomerian and other writings. I think we must therefore say frankly that whatever Madame Blavatsky secured from Tibet is incorporated into the grand body of her concept without being clearly marked as to the area from whence it came. She does refer to certain commentaries or certain symbolic works which she did consult at Tashi Lampu. But for the most part, her indications in this particular area are vague. So for our purposes, I think the best thing to do is to summarize so far as we can what is generally known about Tibetan metaphysics and the general condition of the country prior to the entry of communist China. Tibetan culture is not exceptionally old. We like to think of the Tibetans as having been a very learned people from almost prehistoric times. But actually, their culture, particularly their higher Buddhistic learning, dates from about the 8th or 9th century of the Christian era. Therefore, their entire philosophic structure is probably about 1,000 years old, or possibly a little older. Prior to that time, there is not a great deal of evidence that Tibet was strongly influenced by Indian culture. These wild nomadic tribesmen did not indicate a high degree of previous culture when the early Buddhist missionaries reached the country. became very large as a result of the marriage of a Tibetan chieftain who took to his lonely country two Buddhist wives, one from China and the other from Nepal. These ladies wanted their religion to go with them, and they were successful in persuading this rather primitive, barbaric ruler to introduce Buddhist culture into his country. It had only been there a short time, however, when the extraordinary consequences began to manifest. And in a very short period, less than 100 years, Tibet emerged as a stronghold of Buddhism, partly as a result of the Buddhists seeking new lands for their ministry as India itself began to force them out due to the restoration of Hinduism. Just exactly what type of Buddhism came into Tibet is also somewhat of a mystery. But for all practical purposes, I think we must say that it was the Mahayana, or large vehicle, the same system that was to reach across to the China, Korea, and Japan. The Tibetan Buddhists certainly enjoyed the diversified and highly dramatized concepts of Northern Buddhism. They received what is now known as the Bodhisattva doctrine, the doctrine of the metaphysical extension of Buddhist principles from the ethical to the very highly symbolical form that we find throughout the Northern reach of Buddhistic influence. The primary difference for our purposes between Northern and Southern Buddhism lies very largely in this metaphysical development. In the course of the metaphysics, Buddhism in the Northern areas called upon a number of other beliefs for a certain amount of esoteric material. Whereas Southern Buddhism was always rather severe in its practice, the Northern school began to drift toward the tantric rites and to take on certain colorings from yoga and Vedanta, and even to be influenced by the Jains and Sikhism. All these different beliefs made their contribution to a very elaborate metaphysical system. So that whereas in the Southern school, the principal end was the creation of the Arhat, the dedicated truth seeker, who went forth with only one primary objective, and that was to exhaust worldliness in himself, to end forever the tyranny of sensory perception, to separate his life completely from the involvement in material matters. The Southern Buddhist, in a sense, was trying to extinguish his own individuality in order that he might be reunited into the total substance and essence of eternal existence through the attainment of the Paramivana. This rather broad quest, while it did influence and did attract a certain type of rather disillusioned person, was never the type of thought that could have transformed Buddhism into a real religion. It was too much like German intellectualism. And in that we find, of course, that today the principal exponents in Europe of the Southern school of Buddhism are the Central European people, the intellectuals, who feel that emancipation from all believing is a step in the right direction. And they find in the Southern system of Buddhism this concept of emancipation, this almost total freedom from all dramatization of religion, this severe, hard path to the extinction of self and this liberation from all involvement in worldliness. It is a sort of monasticism which has always intrigued some, but never very many. It is simply too severe a concept. As Buddhism went into the north and passed through the keeping of a series of very brilliant creative thinkers, it developed an apocalyptical concept that was most dramatic and awe-inspiring. It unfolded into a vast psycho-theological structure, a cosmotheism, as it has been called, a structure in which the entire universe is brought into focus, and the path of human growth takes on much of the coloring of yoga and much of the exploring tendency that we have wherever transcendentalism takes a strong hold on human nature. The Buddhism that went into Tibet, therefore, was highly dramatic, highly colorful, and probably suitable peculiarly for the barbaric nature of the people. Instead of demanding the complete renunciation of the previous religion of the country, Northern Buddhism immediately adopted into its own pantheon the mysterious beings, spirits, nature creatures of the Bon religion, which was the indigenous faith of Tibet, doing almost the same in this region that it did in Japan, that it quietly and systematically absorbed Shintoism. Buddhism, instead of declaring the faiths of other men to be false, took the simple ground that all these faiths were merely other interpretations of Buddhism, that there was really no difference at all. Then it became obvious to the king of Tibet that this new faith was going to be of the greatest value to him in the integration of his own country and the advancement of his people to a more highly civilized state. He sent to Narada in central India for a teacher to come to the country, promising that he would establish for him a proper monastery and would set aside the funds required for the printing of books and the general advancement of culture. In reply to this invitation, the monastery sent one of its most interesting and extraordinary men, Padmasambhava, the Blessed Guru. This man, who was really a wizard in his own right, according to legend, made the almost incredible journey across India and across the great Himalaya range, driving before him oxen laden with books, images, and the paraphernalia of religion, arriving safely in the court of the king of Tibet. He was most warmly and happily received, and was given authority to reorganize the religion, which at that time was shamanism, or as we would know it today, much like the faith of the primitive American Indian tribes of this country. The worship of nature, the worship of animals, the creation of simple shrines, and the continuance of human sacrifice. The actual condition of Tibet, therefore, can be best perceived when we are told that it was Padmasambhava who abolished cannibalism in the country. This would almost certainly mean that there was not too high a degree of culture prior to his coming. We are also informed that with the mysterious double-headed thunderbolt, the symbol of the god Indra, later to become one of the most important esoteric symbols of the higher Buddhist mysticism, Padmasambhava converted all of the demons, spirits, and monsters of the ancient Tibetan highlands, rescuing the people from their allegiances to evil spirits and to monstrous forms and ghosts, and transformed all of this hierarchy of elementals into good Buddhists we became servants and defenders of the faith. Thus relieved of the primitive belief, the people began to advance and in a short time developed a written language, had their own literature, and within a very short time, monastic orders were established for both men and women, and the general advancement of the cultural life of the country is noted. Also the development of a proper civil code of laws, the development of medical arts, and the introduction of the basic sciences taught in the Landa, including astronomy, architecture, mathematics, music, art, and literature. All of these changes came so rapidly that within 200 or 300 years, the mysterious Tibet that we think of today came into existence. A country so little understood and so little known that it is the last great place of enchantment on this rather disillusioned planet. It remained, in many respects, this unique, isolated home of religion until the present century. In fact, well into the present century. Then Lord Dal, going into Tibet, he was the medical officer in the Young Husband expedition that carried an army with artillery to Lhasa in the early years of the present century in order to prevent at that time a Russian effort to control the area. Gordel was sympathetic, if not informed. He realized conclusively that whatever these people had as a religion was important. Being entirely different in his thinking, a good son of the Church of England, Wardell was not really equipped to give this Buddhism of Tibet a true interpretation. But he was fair enough to point out that whatever it was and whatever it taught, it had to be important. It had brought these people a degree of culture so rapidly and so remarkably as to be almost without parallel in history. It also raised these people to a tremendous degree of internal strength. And Wardell realized that it could not be the pessimism of Burma and Ceylon that had accomplished this. Because the people of Tibet were a happy people. They were people who loved to laugh. And when you see them even in the North Indian country, around the borders of their own land, where their merchants come down into Kathmandu to trade, you almost always hear Tibetans laughing. Their faces are wreathed in smiles. They have none of the stoical Mongol in them. And they also are a very bizarre people. They enjoy the most fantastic costumes. Like the American Indians, they have a great love for silver and turquoise. And of course, we know in their painting and in their bronze work, they have an extraordinary genius. The wonderful miniature images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas carved and cast by these Tibetan workmen are among the masterpieces of the religious art of the world. In spite of being a comparatively small country with a population never exceeding 2 million, Tibet has made a great many essential contributions to the general improvement of mankind. Far more than we might generally think. In the development of their philosophy, the earliest contacts of Buddhism in Tibet led to the strong development of tantric thinking. Now, tantra is something that is hard for us to really accurately define, but it is a form of oriental transcendental magic. The tantra is a philosophy of spells. It is a philosophy of mantras and mudras, a philosophy of symbols and mandaras, mysterious designs, secret rituals, profound initiation rites. performed in very strange and unworldly situations and environments. The only great temple of Tantric Buddhism outside of Tibet at the time of our day was the Lama Temple in Peking, which also had the honor of being the residence of the only reincarnate Buddha outside of Tibet at the time of the freedom of China before the present Communist Party took over. The Lama Temple in Peking must therefore be regarded as a more or less normal example of tantric symbolism. It was a perfect riot of incredible imagery. I went to the temple many years ago, and there was scarcely a square inch of wall or ceiling that was not adorned with friezes of dancing images, strange multi-armed and multi-headed creatures. There were hundreds of niches draped and curtained along the walls of corridors, in which scenes from the other world were represented in miniature figures of bronze and gold and silver, grotesquely painted and designed. In this same temple, we found something that has not probably been generally recognized, and that is that these people were great sand painters. And with the same type of artistry that occurs among the Navajo and the Hopis of our own Southwest was advanced to a very high degree by the Tibetans, who made magnificent, complicated designs of great religious interest and very beautiful color combinations, all out of ground pigments mixed with sand. And in the Lama Temple in Peking, there were nearly always these great sand mandaras on low tables of platforms to represent Mount Meru or other abodes of the deities. Over this great Tibetan sanctuary in Peking rose the tower which housed the colossal image of the Buddha Maitreya, the Lord to come, a figure over 70 feet in height carved from a cedar tree. This figure was so massive and so extraordinary that it could only be seen by climbing up around on galleries on the walls of the tower. And unless you climbed the tower itself, you could not reach up to the head and shoulders of the image. This tremendous figure, highly venerated, was developed in a full treatment given to the Tibetan imagery and was covered entirely by plates of reddish gold. A fantastic place, presided over by a strange hierarchy of Lamaist priests. A great building filled with dark corridors and mysterious rooms where priests appeared and disappeared almost miraculously from behind curtains and drapes and banners. The walls hung with these marvelous tankas of religious paintings that have become famous all over the world. In these sanctuaries, the secret rituals of the faith were conducted. The initiation rites, the ordination of priests, and in the Lamas temples in Peking, Darjeeling, and in parts of Nepal and Bhutan, and some parts of China also. The old faiths of the mountain people mingled with the cults of India until it seemed that you were in the same kind of atmosphere as in the great carved pagodas, towers, and structures of India, as for example at the great temples at Madura or Madras. There again, this riot of imagery, this incredible depiction of figures, these dancing friezes of human beings, animals, birds, everything you can imagine. A pageantry entirely different from the arts of almost any other people. A pageantry so involved and so grotesque that it offended even the Chinese. It was never popular in Korea. And when the esoteric Buddhist sects reached Japan, the entire extravagance of the art was reduced to the comparative simplicity that we know today. But in Tibet it all lingered and remained. Overlooking the great Potala Plaza, the abode of the Dalai Lama, was another hill climbed on the top by a great university, the University of Tsongkhapa. The original Tantra of Tibet, with its wild and riotous combinations of symbols, soon seemed to be excessive even to the Tibetan mind. And there arose in the country itself a reformer who has been described as the Luther of Tibet, Tsongkhapa. This man was evidently a very devout and very sincere person, opposed spiritually and ethically to the extravagances of the previous faith, and he set himself the task of purifying the religion that had come centuries before from India. So successful was he that he overthrew the power and dynasty of the Gautama Lamas and established an entirely new era of Buddhism in Tibet. It was a very much more simple, orderly, quiet, scholarly approach to the mysteries of religion. And in honor of his scholarship and in honor of his contribution, the great center of spiritual culture in Tibet was named for him and dedicated to his memory. And in the midst of it is his tomb. The story of Tsongkhapa and what he had to contribute to our situation may be somewhat worth summarizing, although there is no real reason to go into the details of it. He was one of those who had the same kind of mind that appears today in the West, a mind very similar in spirit to that of H.P. Blavatsky herself. What he was searching for was the substance beneath the shadow, the reality under the rituals, the meaning beneath the elaborate symbolism. He believed fully and completely that from Miranda had come a great esoteric religious revelation, but that gradually this revelation had been obscured because the local clergy in Tibet simply lacked the understanding, the insight, to perpetuate the more subtle phases of the doctrine. They had never really attained it themselves, and gradually they had developed what might become an orthodoxy. They had simply taken on the outer form of it, they venerated it, they worshipped it, they held the scriptures in the greatest reverence, but they never understood them. So Tsongkhapa wanted to try to restate the essential principles of esoteric Lamaism. Now, as far as is known, there is no text in existence in the Western world that really, actually reveals this esoteric structure. Probably the work that was done by the late Dr. Evans Wentz was as good as is now obtainable. He gained it very largely through cooperation with the Lama Sandhi and others. But at the same time, he is not in a position, or was not in a position, to delve into the deeper phases of Tibetan thought. It is a world that has been left to us because really no one cared, and now the situation is in such poor condition that there is some question as to whether it can ever be restored. There is, however, some discussion now that Tibetans in exile may attempt to put together the story of their culture in some way that will be available to generations to come, that we may be able to restore what we can of the ancient way. At least we should have the knowledge, we should know what it was all about, in the effort at least to become powerfully conscious of the extraordinary beliefs of these people. It is strange that a comparatively small group a minority sect in any sense of the word, should have developed so complete and extraordinary a system of culture. We usually think that great religions accumulate, and that unless a faith has 100 million or 200 million followers, it can scarcely have attained its majority. It cannot have matured the tremendous internal potential. There is a faith that never was numerically important, and yet it did develop a complete system of art, a complete iconography, perhaps one of the most complicated ever devised. It developed its own philosophies, metaphysics, metaphysical systems, its various symbols and emblems, with its remarkable skill and extraordinary creative imagination. And somewhere among these ancient mountains, there were certainly some original thinkers of outstanding ability, great interpreters of wisdom and philosophy. I think we may say that in harmony with Tantra and with other mystical sects of India from which the stream undoubtedly originated, that the Lamaism of Tibet is essentially a system of yoga. In other words, that it is very largely based upon secret disciplines for the development of the spiritual centers in human bodies and in the consciousness of man. It is a mysterious, magical way of growing, a way dominated by breath and by the use of certain symbols and emblems with esoteric meaning. The use of sound, the magic of the intoning of sacred names, the use of utter mesmeric processes by which the individual could throw himself into cataleptic states, the use of extraordinary symbols which in one way or another excited the inner mental imagination of the beholder, in that way combining him or uniting him in some mysterious manner with principles and with laws otherwise not intelligible to him. In this pattern, of course, we seem to be coming very close to the basic concept of most ancient religions. Pythagoras, visiting Egypt, said that he saw in the temples there all of the deities represented by geometrical solids, through the contemplation of which certain reactions were aroused within consciousness. Therefore, I think we must assume that the entire symbolism of the Tibetan imagery is archetypal and is very carefully calculated to produce a particular and special effect within the consciousness of the Tibetan people. Almost certainly and inevitably, however, this symbolism is only valid for individuals who have the background of the Tibetan culture itself, because the symbols bring to mind principles, truths, ideals, rites, ceremonies, and rituals which are only known to the Tibetans. Therefore, the non-Tibetan cannot possibly receive the complete impact of these symbols. He may be bewildered by them, astonished by them, and experience certain metaphysical extensions through them. But their true meaning is for those who have been brought up in the philosophy, who have studied it all their lives and are fully aware of its deepest meanings. Tsongkhapa, for example, certainly gave to the people a wonderful system of medicine. He was a scientist of skill. He taught not only physical therapies as we know them, but all kinds of magical and magnetic forms of healing. The graduates of his college in near Lhasa were certainly persons who possessed an understanding of medicine totally different from that of the West. And in some cases, of course, Western learning was obviously superior. But in other cases, there is much to indicate that there was much more psychological depth to the Tibetan system than we have ever been able to evolve here in the West. The great systems of psychotherapy, of soul culture, of health from within the individual, these were developed in these mysterious and remote areas. One reason, perhaps, why the Tibetans were able to accomplish as much as they did was their isolation. Isolation has a tendency to mature a civilization from within itself. The isolated culture must depend upon itself for survival. It cannot enjoy the labors of other peoples. Western man civilization has been built up by constant contact with other people. Western culture has descended from a long stream of previous achievements. We are benefiting today from Greece and Rome and Egypt and Persia. We are also benefiting at all times from the discoveries of other culture groups of our own period. Thus, we are not able to say with certainty to the degree we are indebted to Germany or Italy or France or England for advancements in all types of learning. Out of such advancements comes the tendency of the individual to depend more and more heavily upon the collective knowledge of his society. Today it seems that almost anything we want to know we can find out by asking someone or reading something. It has all been done. It has all been made available, and progress from here on is largely building upon this polyglot structure that already exists. In Tibet, this was not true. And another startling example of where it was not true was in Japan, which was completely isolated for 300 years. And from that isolation developed its own arts, its own cultures, its own metaphysics, its own mysticism, in a way which is quite different from that other culture which is in constant contact with other people. Tibet was, of course, the most perfect example of total isolation among the major cultures of the world. These people lived alone, unknown, and untouched, except by boundary people such as the Mongols. They had to develop almost every phase of knowledge from within the cultural life of their own people. They had to create both their educators and their education. And they had to perpetuate this among only their own stock. Century after century, therefore, they dug in. They had to answer their own questions. And with the exception of an occasional wanderer who brought a flash of light to them from somewhere, they matured and developed their own complete theory of life. Because it was developed in this way, because in it there was no conflict such as is always present in a confusion of beliefs, these people developed a tremendous penetration, an intensity almost unique in the history of religion. Furthermore, their location not only isolated them, but gave them certain other psychological conditionings. First of all, they lived in a highly mountainous area. They lived in one of the most rugged, magnificent terrains there is in the world. People go from everywhere simply to see that which is the common homeland of these people. Like nearly every group that has lived in a highly mountainous region, lived very close to the immensities of natural surroundings and natural happenings. People who have not been overly wealthy, but have been forced to gather their sustenance from the rugged and rugged heights that approach the timberline at all times. And more than this, even people whose respirational system was adapted to an average altitude of from 15 to 18,000 feet. These conditions all affected the lives of the people. it has been observable everywhere that people dwelling in high atmosphere and in high altitudes seem to have a peculiarly sensitive reaction to spiritual matters. They seem to be more pure in their psychic nature than those living in lower altitudes or among congested cultural patterns. In any event, by themselves, a hermit people, a people, the whole group, born, living, and dying in, you might almost say, retreat from the rest of the world. We have this unfolding of a highly meditational way of life. And perhaps no other civilization is so completely archetypal in its thinking. This is where we have great psychological importance. These people thought things through with the equipment that man has received. And they proved conclusively the magnificent job the human being can accomplish in putting the universe in order as far as his own needs are concerned. We find every necessary indication that the human being can perfect from within himself a knowledge sufficient to his every need. And furthermore, that under certain favorable conditions, he can anticipate the knowledge later to be accomplished by much more scientific methods. The Tibetan is a proof that science is not essential to the development of a great creative insight, that the individual is capable of evolving from within himself a magnificently purposed pattern of life. In the northern area, in the Tibetan group culture, we also find a very advanced form of philosophy. A philosophy which binds itself to the thinking of India and China. A philosophy that is extraordinarily mature and wise in a great many ways. Yet this philosophy has come into the keeping of comparatively simple people. This is another amazing thing that we find. It is quite possible to imagine a man like Plato attaining to a great wisdom. But it is difficult to reconcile great wisdom with a Tibetan yak herder who has never had any of the advantages or privileges that we know. Yet this person has an innate understanding of values. He knows without really knowing what he knows or how he knows. Yet he lives in a universe permeated by dimensions of value that are almost unknown to us. And the more we consider his interpretations of things, the more we respect them. We find that he has made a very important and valid contribution. Being by nature essentially a Buddhistic country, it is natural that the Tibetans should also develop their concept of the basic power at the source of life. And in this we find the emergence of the concept of the Adi Buddha. We see the universe coming into existence as a result of the compassionate contemplations of a great hierarchy of celestial, or at least neo-celestial beings. We find the Tibetan using Adi Buddha interchangeably with the word cosmos, or its equivalent. In other words, the deity and the total existence must be regarded as identical. We have not yet reached this point in Western thinking, but we are approaching it. For in actuality, these other people were further along in this type of thinking than we are today. This sudden realization that life and all living things constitute identity, that everything that exists is part of something, And that this something must be understood as universal mind, universal being, universal essence. But actually, at the root of all things is the eternal thinker. No other term has perhaps been quite as applicable or as purposeful in describing the mysterious power of the diamond thunderbolt, this mysterious personalization of universal reality, seated forever, ever upon the rock and roof of thunderbolts, a tremendous space concept, a being suspended in energy, composed of energy, ruling all things by energy, and manifesting from the root of itself all the energies, substances, and essences of life. A concept of this kind would really have paralyzed Western man 500 years ago. We could not even have considered it. It would have been utterly meaningless to us. Yet the advancement of science has revealed to us the universe of energy. And all that the Tibetan has done is to consider this energy not as merely a continuous flowing force, but as the manifestation of an eternal being, that energy is. Energy, in fact, is truth, is life, is reality. And this energy exists in every type and form conceivable. Because of its vitality, we have consciousness, we have emotion, we have thought. This same energy keeps planets in their orbits, keeps the sun blazing in the heavens. This energy regulates the seasons, contributing to every phenomenon, from the mystery of cosmic light down to the smallest reproduction of a microorganism. There is only one eternal energy, and this energy is a fabric, is a substance, a woven together of forces. And while it is totally invisible, it sustains everything. And because of this energy, things cannot fall apart. Nothing can collapse. Nothing can for one instant die. For there is no way in which any living organism can be actually, ultimately separated from energy. And this energy then becomes the subject of the eternal contemplation of the Tibetan mystic. How is he to understand it? How is he to bring it within the rationalization of his own consciousness? How is he to use it to explain all of the mysteries that emerge from itself? What is in this energy? And how is it to be explained and defined? Can it be analyzed? Or must it be simply accepted? The Tibetan, looking for an appropriate symbol or emblem for this energy, creates the figure of a great seated Buddha in meditation, a being crowned with the attributes of rulership, a lord of the wheel, a king of the cycle, a being, however, which remains forever immovable, its vastness known to us only by the dim intellectual form of an eternally meditating being, a being whose meditation fills all space, a being its nature itself, being identical with space, a being which creates only internally, that nothing is ever born from this being but within it, because every process of it is an internal meditation, realization, or concentration. Thus creation can only be a mood, a dream, a condition set up in the eternal nature of this eternal dreamer. This meditational nature not only indicates the divine attributes, but it also indicates man's journey to reality. If everything in nature is essentially introverted, if everything ultimately and finally lives within itself, and all that appears to be without itself or outside of itself is merely a series of dreams or images or impressions derived from sensory perception, then we come to the conclusion that we can see other things, that we can understand only ourselves. We can be in communication with other beings, but our purposeful endeavor has to arise only from within ourselves. The only thing we can possibly do for each other is to help each other to discover themselves, not to discover ourselves. All the divine processes, therefore, consist of moods set up in infinite consciousness. And this infinite consciousness is a substance, an essence, a principle, a life. It is whatever you want to call it. But intrinsic in it, and part inevitably of it, must be everything that emerges from it. And the first thing that emerges from this consciousness itself may be said to be the pattern or the grand plan of things. Therefore, it is assumed in Tibetan philosophy that the eternal thinker envisions within its own nature all that will be produced therefrom, visualization being the basis of what we call creation. Creation is actually bringing forth things in the mind. And because cosmic mind fills all space, it is perfectly conceivable to us that things have a space existence. But while they seem to exist in a space, a location, they are actually existing in a mind condition. As a result of this type of philosophy, it becomes further obvious, as the ancient tantric system so clearly set forth, that everything that we know is mental magic. Everything that we know is a process of mentation. Evolution, growth, all these are finally experiences of cosmic mind. And we understand them, discover them, become adjusted to them simply because we are also cosmic mind. And the great problem that we all face, as Buddha himself pointed out, is to annihilate the distance between individual mind and cosmic mind. Therefore, growth actually represents readjustment with the cosmic intelligence or consciousness itself. Tantra, yoga, Vedanta, all of these systems are systems of reconciliation or realization, systems which depend for their validity upon their ability to bring the individual back into relationship with the eternal mind. The use of human mind as a bridge to unite the personality of the individual with the universality of truth itself. Now, this is quite a concept for people living in these wild areas with a cultural background that to us appears little more than barbaric. And yet it was essentially the basis of a tremendous inward experience. This experience of the individual creating his own lonely road, so to say, from phenomena to the luminous state of things. From things as they appear to things as they are. From not being to being, from not essence to essence. This tremendous journey, the journey which alone seemed important. The mysterious science of sciences, which alone seemed to hold any solution to the problems of mankind. In this, of course, the Tibetan is quite orthodox in his Buddhism. And I think we have to realize that in this area also, Madame Blavatsky found a great deal of supporting testimony in the Trans-Asian metaphysical theory. We have, for example, in her writings, the clear evidence that she believed in what might be termed a secret doctrine about life. Now, what this secret doctrine really is, if she was inspired by Northern Asiatic thinkers, this esoteric system is all involved in this extraordinary process of universal thought. Yoga is simply a phase of mind culture by which the individual seeks to rescue the intellect from isolation and restore it to identity with cosmic mind. Almost every type of esoteric culture that we know for the regeneration and improvement of man has to do with this journey inward to the substance of truth itself. So that we have in theosophy, and always have had, this realization that is essentially Buddhistic, namely that the individual must achieve union with reality, yoga, through the gradual liberation of consciousness from bondage to illusion of all kinds as this illusion exists in the world of generated things. In other words, man to find reality must outgrow that which is not real in every aspect and phase of his being. He must realize, as the Eastern thinker has always realized, that the total reality which he seeks is not to be found in phenomenal existence or its relationships. It is not to be found in the world of seeming, in the world of things interpreted by our own objective faculties.